Hi, this is Meredith Irvine, editor of compensationstandards.com. Welcome to the Pay and Proxy podcast. Today, I'm welcoming back Sherry Adler, a partner in Troutman Pepper's Philadelphia office. Today, Sherry joins us to discuss the upcoming shift to T+1 settlement and the impact on equity award withholding. Sherry, before we jump into substance, can you just share with our listeners a little bit about your own background?
Sure. Thank you so much for hosting me, Meredith. It's always a pleasure to be here. I'm a partner in the employee benefits and executive compensation practice at Troutman Pepper, where I work with all types of companies on executive compensation matters with a focus on public companies and related disclosure issues. I also co-lead the exec comp and security subgroup in our firm, which is an internal group focused on cross-collaboration between exec comp lawyers, securities lawyers, and litigators.
So this topic that we're talking about today is more complicated than I think meets the eye. So can we start with some background? And would you mind just chatting with us about when tax becomes due for various types of equity awards?
Sure. So let's start with some of the most common types of equity awards. So first of all, a non-qualified stock option. In a non-qualified stock option, it's granted to an individual. At some point, it vests, and then the individual usually has a bunch of years in which to exercise if they choose to do so. In that scenario, there's no tax on grant and there's no tax on vesting. So there's only tax if and when the individual decides to exercise that option. And the amount of the tax is the spread, meaning the difference between the fair market value when they choose to exercise and the exercise price paid, which is typically the fair market value on the date of grant. Stock appreciation rights, similar concept, also taxed at exercise. Then we've got restricted stock. So these are actual shares of stock that are transferred upfront. A property transfer occurs on day one, and they're typically subject to forfeiture over time based on, let's say, continued service over a period of time. So the default for restricted stock is also there's no tax on grant. There is tax upon vesting, and that's based on the fair market value of a share at the time of vesting. That said, grantees can make an 83B election within the first 30 days of grant, which means that they're opting out of being taxed later at vesting. They want to be taxed in full upfront on the grant. And that means that the amount that they're taking in as income is tied to the fair market value of those shares on grant, not on vesting. Lastly, restricted stock units are very common for public companies, and these can be both time-based vesting and performance-based vesting awards. Restricted stock units, there's no transfer of property at the beginning. It's a promise to pay shares at some time in the future based on the fulfillment of these various vesting conditions. So for an RSU, there's no tax on grant, and there's actually no tax on vesting technically. The tax arises when the award is settled based on the fair market value of a share at that time. Now, sometimes this is right after vesting, so people like to think of it about tax on vesting. But sometimes there's a deferral in place, right? And so someone vests into an RSU, but under a 401(a) compliant deferral plan, they're not receiving that RSU until much later, let's say a separation from service, at which time the income tax obligation arises. The caveat is that for non-qualified deferred compensation, FICA could be due at an earlier time for these types of awards.
Yep. So we've talked about when tax becomes due for an employee. Let's move to the company's withholding obligation. Can you talk a little bit about the different methods for withholding?
Absolutely. So the couple of most common methods that we see a lot, one is cash. So that's simple, right? If you're being paid wages, as you know, your cash amount, you'll receive net of whatever is withheld by the company, and you'll see that on your W-2, right? In this type of award, also, you could ask an employee to write a check for the cash amount that is due for withholding, and then the employer goes ahead and remits that to the IRS. More commonly, though, for equity awards, we'll see some type of share withholding. So one way to do this is through net settlement. There, the company withholds shares from the award that are sufficient to cover the withholding obligation, and it only delivers the net amount of shares to the grantee. The employer then has to remit cash to the IRS because you can't pay the tax obligation in shares. So in that scenario, the employer, right, it has to have enough liquidity to be able to pay the IRS because all it's doing is delivering less shares to the employee. Another method, particularly for employers who may not have that liquidity on hand, is sell to cover. And in that case, a broker actually sells on the market enough shares from the award to cover tax withholding. That then is turned into cash. And so the employer has cash in hand to remit to the IRS. And again, the employee only receives the net amount of shares at the end of the transaction in their account.
So what about the employer's responsibilities for actually depositing the federal income tax withheld? And what are the potential penalties if a company fails to do that?
Yeah, so that's really the crux of the issue. So that's a great question, Meredith. So generally, employers have a deposit period during which tax liabilities are accumulated, and then they're paid by a certain due date. But importantly, there's a rule which is referred to as the next day deposit rule. And that says if an employer accumulates $100,000 or more in taxes on any day during a deposit period, it has to deposit the tax with the IRS by the next business day, regardless of the normal schedule. And there are significant penalties for failing to do so. So this can range from 2% to 15% based on the number of days the employer is late. So how does this play out into the equity withholding world? So as to timing, the next day deposit rule really interacted with the SEC rules about the timing for settling securities. And that's why it's in question now as to how does it work under the new T+1 rules. So under the prior SEC rules, company had T+2 days to settle broker-assisted securities transactions. So that meant if the company initiated settlement of an RSU on a Tuesday, which was T or a transaction date, then the brokerage firm had until Thursday or T+2 to deliver the shares into the employee's brokerage account. And as we know, on May 28th, this is changing to T+1. So Wednesday is the new deadline. So how does that tie into the tax rules? When does the next day deposit have to be made if the amount is accumulated to over 100,000? So in 2020, the IRS made clear in guidance that the amount of the withholding liability that arises, it's tied to the T date. So that's the date that the RSU settlement is initiated or the employee takes action to exercise their stock option. So in our example, that's a Tuesday. However, the IRS said you don't have to remit the taxes by Wednesday in order to be timely on the next day deposit rule. There was a GLAM and an Internal Revenue Manual guidance putting those together. The end result was that you actually had until the day after the settlement was completed to remit the taxes. So in our example, under a T+2 regime, that meant that on Tuesday, the company initiated settlement of the RSU. That is the T date on which was the reference date to figure out the amount of withholding liability due. But if the company didn't actually deliver the shares into the brokerage account until Thursday, then the company had until Friday to actually remit the cash and the taxes to the IRS.
So with that background, this change from the SEC to this T+1 settlement, that, as you mentioned, May 28th is the date. So we don't have a ton of time for equity plan administrators to prepare for this. How does this change how equity plan administrators are going to be handling withholding and depositing?
So now, if the company is initiating settlement of their RSU on a Tuesday, under the T+1 rules, the shares need to show up in the employee's brokerage account by Wednesday, T+1. So what that means is that under current IRS guidance, you know, unless anything changes, the company will now need to pay withholding by Thursday because it is the day after the award is settled to meet the next day deposit rule. Again, the timeline hasn't changed in terms of figuring out the amount of the liability. That is still tied to T, but the timeline is shortened because it piggybacks off of when settlement happens. Because settlement happened Wednesday, now Thursday is the new due date for taxes to be remitted.
And part of the issue here is that if companies are not aware of the new deadline, there are penalties that accrue by the number of days late. Is that right?
That's right. And I think, you know, companies are generally aware, right? Everyone in the industry is aware. It's more a matter of nervousness about how are we going to make this happen so quickly? How are we going to make sure we have everyone's withholding figured out quickly enough and have the entire process completed in order to remit on a timely basis?
So with that in mind, are there steps companies can be taking now to ensure that they can do that in time once the change to T+1 is effective in May?
Yeah. So a lot of stock administrators that I've been speaking with, they have a lot of great plans in action, right? There's a lot of third parties out there, a lot of vendors out there that we've been talking to. And, you know, they are talking about getting organized administratively, having team meetings with your stock administrator, your treasury, legal, payroll, finance, just to make sure that everyone is on the same page to ensure the process is happening timely. And a lot of those vendors are talking a lot about automation, right? Are your payroll numbers up to date? Are they being fed into the system so that you know exactly what percentages you need to withhold and you're ready to go in a quick manner? One planning note for something that's been crossing our desk is we talked about how the liability is tied to that Tuesday, that transaction date, in terms of figuring out the amount of the withholding. So it's tied to the fair market value on that initial transaction date. However, the IRS rules don't hardwire in a definition of fair market value there. So there is some flexibility in that regard. You obviously need to pick a reasonable method, but it doesn't necessarily have to be closing price on the day of the transaction, T. If the fair market value method that you use to figure out withholding is closing price on the date of the transaction, or T, then obviously you have to wait until the market closes on that Tuesday, and then that night or the next morning, start to do your calculations. But let's say you're a company that defines the fair market value for these purposes as opening price on the day of the transaction. Now you can get started the morning, Tuesday morning. Or let's say you define it as closing price on the date preceding the transaction. Now, Monday night already, you know that you are going to be initiating settlement of a large amount of RSUs the night before. You can already have the team starting to figure out the withholding liabilities. So we are seeing companies looking at this and considering the method that they use. You'll want to make sure that whatever method the company is using is consistently applied across the board, and it doesn't look to the IRS like you're manipulating it for any purpose. You'll want to also think about, if you need to change the method, what are the formalities that are needed? You know, for example, some equity plans actually hardwire in a definition for fair market value to be used for withholding purposes. And if that's the case, you may need to amend your equity plan. Typically, it's the type of amendment that can be done just with board approval and doesn't require shareholder approval. You know, under the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ rules, look at what the plan says, but typically that would be the case. Other times, the plan might not hardwire it, so it may be just an internal sort of ministerial decision that is being documented. You know, the tax function internally, there is a decision that is made. We are now going to use closing price on the day preceding the transaction going forward. Even though in this area, there's no definition that has to be used for fair market value, there are other areas in the IRS regs which give us an idea of what the IRS has considered reasonable in other contexts to define fair market value. So for example, under the 409A regs, what is fair market value for the purposes of figuring out an option exercise price? And again, that can be closing price on the day of the transaction, closing price the day preceding the transaction, arithmetic means of high and low on the day of or the day preceding the transaction. So we do have other examples out there that we've seen that are considered reasonable in other contexts by the IRS for what is fair market value of a public company share. So I think that's the main thing from a planning perspective we're seeing, at least from the legal side, is just something that companies are looking at is there any way we can just help ourselves if we're feeling nervous about this time crunch? And maybe it's about, what are you using to define fair market value for these purposes?
Yep. So some steps to take to get your ducks in a row, and then also whether you can make life easier for yourself by using an earlier fair market value. That makes a lot of sense. Sherry, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And thanks for everyone to list for listening in. There are a lot of things that equity plan administrators should be considering in plan for May 28th. Thanks for listening.